Sebastian got his master's at the University of Cambridge in 2015, when Bianca and I were very, very lucky that he decided to come to Perimeter for his PhD under our supervision. He got his PhD in 2019, and from here he moved to the IES, where he's been a long-term member of the School of Natural Sciences since then. And today he's going to tell us about do's and don'ts of quantum time. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Freddie, for this wonderful introduction and for the invitation to this to give this colloquium. And it's a real pleasure to be here back at the Perimeter. So I'm going to start this talk with a simple observation that I'm sure many of you would have seen in your undergraduate classes. So let me consider a heat equation here, where psi is the some heat density. And on the left-hand side, we have a time derivative, tau. And on the right-hand side, we have a Laplacian here, let's say, in one dimension, and some positive constant alpha. All right, the physics of this equation is actually incredibly simple. What happens is if I start with some clump of heat and I evolve time forward, what's going to happen is, of course, the heat starts dispersing, and it follows these curves in here. In fact, this this equation is so simple, you can, in fact, write down an explicit analytic solution which takes form of this Gaussian here up to some prefactors that is plotted upstairs. Now, what I'm going to do is write a very similar looking equation, namely the Schrödinger equation here in one dimension, and also in the free case when there's no interactions. This equation looks very, very similar to the one that we've seen before. Once again, on the left-hand side, we have the time derivative, which now I call the time variable t. And we have this extra factor of minus I on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, since it's the free equation, we only have the Laplacian defined up to some positive constant that I can simply identify with the alpha on the previous slide. All right, so now the physics of that is quite different. Of course, it, in this case, it describes what happens with some, for example, wave packets evolve in time. And what you can see is that if I evolve t forward, the wave packet actually starts moving to the right, as we're used to from quantum mechanics. However, the solution that I would write down for this equation is exactly the same as we've seen on the previous slides. The only difference is that I've identified tau on the previous slide with the IT on this one, and I've evaluated it in a different parameter, P. Okay, of course, this should not be a surprise. This is an example of a famous kind of an analytic continuation called the weak rotation, and it can be understood by looking at what happens in the T complex plane, so complex plane of the time. And the equation that we just looked at a second ago, the one describing quantum mechanics, is living here on the positive axis. And then what we've done, what we can do to go back to the heat equation is analytically continue to the negative imaginary axis by identifying these two versions of time. Okay, so even though we're used to these kind of types of weak rotation, let me just kind of emphasize how crazy this is. These are two systems that are kind of defined, that are describing different types of physics. One is the quantum mechanics, the other one is some heat equation. But nevertheless, if I write a solution for one, I automatically get a solution for the other as well. So we're used to doing this kind of analytic continuations in across many areas of physics, especially those represented here at Perimeter. For example, in lattice field theory, we would usually write down the correlation functions on the Euclidean lattice and then try to interpret that as some kind of Lorentzian evolution of the dynamics of QCD. Another example is black holes. As the Psi students have learned last week, you can compute the, for example, the Hawking temperature associated with a black hole by doing an analytic continuation from Euclidean time. There's many other applications, including those in condensed matter and perhaps some aspects of cosmology as well. Right? However, this talk will be slightly more complicated. What we're going to do is we're going to consider even more intricate ways of analytically continuing in the time variable. And we're going to see exactly what I mean by this statement. But roughly speaking, you can think of it as what we're going to do is not only consider time going in the being real or imaginary, but also somewhere in between, and sometimes also continuing a subset of particles, leaving the other subset invariant. Of course, doing such analytic continuations requires you to have a deep understanding of the analytic structure of the type of observable that you study. So I can even illustrate it here on the simple example. What I could have asked for is what happens if I evolve my wave packet not to the future, but instead to the past. All right, so I want to be somewhere here on the negative real axis. And there's actually two ways that I can do it. So the question you might have is, which one is the correct one? Which one has a good physical interpretation, and so on? And we see this happens even in the simplistic example. And of course, it's going to be much, much more complicated in the examples that follow. So in general, what you want to be able to answer is, first of all, for my observable, where are the singularities? Second of all, how to avoid having such singularities? How do I go around them? And most importantly for the physics is what's on the other side. So of course, this is going to be only useful if the result of the analytic continuation is going to have some physical meaning and perhaps enable new computations. So this is the plan for the talk. We're going to consider these different ways of thinking about complexified space-time and some scattering processes in it. And I'm going to illustrate it on three examples. First of all, we're going to talk about kind of vanilla particle physics collisions, the type of collisions that occur every day at the LHC. Then next, I'm going to move on to applications to gravitational waves and trying to quantify the amounts of gravitational radiation emitted in a scattering event of two heavy bodies. And thirdly, I will move to some more formal topics, including high energy scattering in string theory. Okay, so the real message that I wanted to get across in this talk is how very often we're going to see how having some new insights into the foundations of scattering theory or having some new insights into the basics of quantum field theory is going to lead to practical applications, and not only practical applications in a single domain, but also those across different domains, such as the ones I will highlight in this talk. Okay, so the first one will be particle physics. All right, so here we're interested in a collider kind of experiments. So let's say I have two particles, say with the momentum P1 and P2, and then I smash them together. And of course, what we're interested in is that once some other stuff is going to fly out, we want to quantify by understanding the probabilities for those events to happen, want to quantify the physics of interactions that took place. Okay, so one of the variables that we're going to encounter over and over again is this center of mass energy squared, S, which is the sum of the two momenta squared. Okay, so how do we formulate it in the language of quantum field theory? Well, there the central object is the so-called S matrix, or the scattering matrix. And more specifically, what we're typically interested in are its matrix elements. All right, so we have some Brian cat in and out, and then we put an S operator in between them. So at the level of this talk, it's going to be easier to illustrate everything with pictures. So in this picture, let's say that the in state with some free particles, then they interact through the S operator, and they fly out as some other set of particles, in this case, free other ones. So if you think about the time evolution, in this case, the time flows, of course, from the in to the out state. Okay, it's very simple. Now, a fundamental constraint that you have on your S matrix is the unitarity constraint. So unitarity encodes the physical notion of probability conservation. In this case, it tells us that S times S dagger is equal to the identity, which simply tells you that all probabilities add up to one. Now, in this business, it's actually very useful to separate out the identity element from the as operator, which is the part in which nothing interesting happens. And we separate it from the T operator, which is where the interactions take place. So now what we're going to do on the next slide is simply plug in this identity back into the unitarity equation. So what this tells us is that we get a quadratic constraint. And that quadratic constraint is called the optical theorem. So on the left-hand side here, we have a linear term that looks like it wants to be the imaginary part of the T matrix element. And on the right-hand side, we have this combination T dagger T. Now, what we want to do with it is we're going to sandwich this between some in and out state. And moreover, we're going to insert a complete basis of states, an identity, between these two T operators. So what do I mean by this? Is that we have to sum over all intermediate states, on-shell states in your theory X, and also integrate over their intermediate phase space. Okay? So that equation is actually easier to understand at the level of pictures. So on the left-hand side, I have the imaginary part of my interacting part of the S matrix. And on the right-hand side, I have the same formula in which I have some in that interacts with the T matrix element. Then I produce some intermediate states. And then it flies out by interacting through the T dagger. Okay, so here I've inserted this dash in orange in here. This is something that we call the unitarity cut. The unitarity cut tells you that you're supposed to sum over these intermediate states. And there's actually a constraint that you have here, because that cut is only allowed if the energy, total energy that you have in your scattering event is large enough that you can actually produce some of these intermediate particles with some masses m1, m2, and so on, and so on. So this immediately tells us something interesting about the S matrix. It tells us that it has a lot of discontinuities. Right? A discontinuity is going to appear whenever a new term is allowed here on the right-hand side when this inequality is saturated. Okay? Now, if you wanted to come back to the question of where the time evolves, of course, on the left-hand side, it just goes from left to right. Here, because we have a T conjugate, the conjugate essentially reverses the arrow of time to go to the from right to left instead of left to right. Okay? So in case this might look slightly alien, let's just recall a useful interpretation of this right-hand side of this equation here. If you actually set the in and out states to be the same, so you're studying the forward term, okay, then this is actually computing the cross section. And now this interpretation, of course, makes complete sense because it's a total cross section for the in state to go to into anything x. So of course, anything x has to be always to the future of both in states. Okay, now let me argue that this is just the tip of the iceberg. And in fact, the entirety implies an infinite number of discontinuities. So what we're going to do here is take the equation from the previous slide, the optical theorem. I'm going to solve it for the T dagger and then plug it back again. Okay, so if I solve it for T dagger on the left-hand side, then I'm going to get this equation, and then I just plug it back here. Okay, so I get an equivalent unitarity constraint, but now it looks slightly more complicated. In fact, I can keep doing this over and over. I can just keep plugging T dagger over and over. And what this does is actually it exposes all sorts of other patterns of interactions that can happen in the S matrix. So to illustrate this point, let me just take one of those terms, say this one, which contains three powers of T here. And what I have to do here is insert two resolutions of identity between every pair. So let me call the intermediate states X and Y. And now we can see that we can have an interaction pattern that takes form of this triangle interaction. Actually, if you wanted to think about the time evolution in this case, you would associate forward, and backward evolution because of the dagger. OK, but the key point that I wanted to illustrate here is that just like we've seen on the previous example, the energy has to be enough so that these intermediate states can be produced. Okay, so likewise, in this example, there's going to be a similar constraint. There's going to be some function of the kinematic invariance. Let me just call it f, such that f has to be large enough for this to be physically or kinematically allowed. Okay, so what this means is that there's going to be a singularity associated to a point where this just barely opens up. So let me just clarify, whenever we usually talk about singularities in the S-matrix language, what this corresponds to is that it could be either a pole, so for example, 1 over f would be an example of such a singularity, or a branch point, which could be, for example, a square root or a logarithmic branch point as this new threshold opens up. Okay, so let me kind of, at this stage, I think it's useful to emphasize that singularities actually encode a lot of physics. So for example, the analyticity in the momentum transfer, so this variable here, p2 plus p3, then let me call it t, which is space-like, is closely related to locality. So the way to think about it is that if I start with some, say, Yukawa potential here, that has some characteristic mass scale mu, which could be, for example, mass of a pion, then it corresponds to a singularity in the t channel that looks like 1 over t with the appropriate mass scale inserted here. So I see if I expand around t, around the origin in the t plane, the analyticity is bounded by this pole. And by reading off the value of this pole, you can associate with that the length scale of locality. Okay, there's also another very interesting connection that I will not have a lot of time to explain right now, but you can prove that analyticity in the energy variable is associated with the notion of causality. So you can ask me later on after this talk, or you can have a look at one of those references. Okay, so now a very important point is going to be that actually most of those singularities that I just drew on the previous slide are complex. So they're in a sense in complex kinematics or in complexified spacetime. They're actually called anomalous thresholds or sometimes also Landau singularities. So let me look at this example that of the triangle interaction that we've just seen on the previous slides. Okay, so let's think about what kind of constraints do I have to put to determine whether this is physically allowed. So first of all, there's some intermediate particles with momentum k1, k2, k3, and so on. And first of all, they have to be onshell states, so I have to put them on the mass shell. Second of all, I have to impose that they are interacting at these specific places in spacetime, x1, x2, x3, and so on. So now we have a system of constraints that you can try to solve. And as you might be familiar, whenever you have a system of constraints that is sufficiently nonlinear, its generic solution is going to be complex. That is certainly not an exception in here. You would find that in principle, if you solve all of these constraints for the values of the both momenta and the spacetime variables, they're complexified. So this is something that we have to get used to usually in this business. We have to think about these cuts as in the appropriate sense of analytic continuation beyond the real kinematics and beyond the real spacetime. Okay? In particular, if you wanted to think about the zero component, either of the energy or the time, in general, it will be somewhere in between real and purely imaginary. All right, so at this stage, you can think about the following question. Well, great, we have all sorts of complex singularities, but, well, ultimately, why do we care? Well, why is it useful? And let me just highlight a couple of examples in which we actually do care about it. And typically, this is associated with making high-precision measurements in quantum field theory. Okay, so one example actually comes from a non-perturbative approach to studying complex singularities. So I'm going to show you just some data from an experiment that measures radiative corrections, radiative decays of the J psi into pions and kaons. Okay, so you can actually take the experimental data and then you can try to infer as a function of the complex energy, so square root of s, you can infer where the poles in the complex plane should be from the peaks available in the experimental data. And each of them has a physical interpretation. So for example, if you look at the real part of the energy, that actually measures the mass of the associated bound state. And the imaginary part of the axis is measuring the width of that state. So in this way, you can actually probe the QCD bound states by analyzing the positions of the complex poles in this complexified space. Okay, this is, of course, a very, very simple example. But it turns out that nowadays, people studying hadron spectroscopy are more and more interested in trying to apply this kind of analytic gas matrix techniques to discovering new hadrons. In fact, they've recently emphasized this in this NOMAS review, that the close connection to S-matrix analyticity will be needed for the discovery of new bound states. Okay, now let me move on to a topic which is even closer to my heart, which is the existence of complex singularities in perturbative computations. So you can think of it as perturbative computations needed for the precision frontier of the of QCD. Okay, so we can look at this simple diagram in here, which is a one loop with the diagram that depends on some invariant masses, some Mandelstam kinematic invariants, and the mass of the intermediate particle. And in this case, the diagram is actually simple enough that you can just compute it, and here's the answer. And one thing that I want to highlight in here is that, as you can notice, the answer has actually a lot of singularities. So for example, here there's a pole when some function is going to zero. Here we have a dial algorithm, which has a lot of branch cuts, for example, when this quantity is becoming zero, and so on and so on. If you actually count how many singularities there are in this one loop amplitude, you would find that there's actually 17 distinct singularities, both poles and branch points. And here's the point. If you actually wanted to know the expression, you don't care if there are physical singularities, if they're somewhere off in the complex plane. If you actually wanted to have the explicit expression, such as this one, you need to know all of them, okay? No matter on which Riemann sheet they are. And it turns out that in a very precise sense, this is actually one of the bottlenecks in the recent computations of perturbative QCD, basically trying to understand the locations and the nature of such singularities. In fact, the analyticity enters at all stages of the modern pipeline for the standard model computations. So perhaps many of you, or some of you, would have seen this topic being associated with a number of buzzwords, including generalized singularity, differential equations, symbol alphabets, and so on and so on. And to analyze all of them, you need to have a deep insight into the analytic structure of perturbative amplitudes. Okay, so to me, this is really a starting point of kind of a great intellectual adventure into studying analytic properties of the S matrix. And we could be here for another couple of hours trying to flesh out all of the details. Luckily for you, you actually have a number of experts here at Perimeter, including Freddy, who has written a book on the Grassmannian geometry of scattering amplitudes. So if you're interested in knowing more details, I would invite you to reach out to either him or other faculty members in the group. So instead of going through all of the details, what I'm going to do is present some of the highlights that I think are kind of the most striking. So the one of the highlights is going to be this computation of the MHV remainder function. So there's a lot of quantifiers here. Just don't worry about any of that. The point is that if you compute this specific quantity here in terms of kind of your vanilla Feynman diagram computation, and you try to write it down, it's going to take 17 pages. You can look it up in this paper. But what happens is that upon closer inspection, some of those terms, individual terms, contain a lot of spurious singularities. So if you had some insight into what you think the singularities should be, this would look suspicious, and you would think that that answer can be simplified. And indeed, this is what this group did here in the same year, they discovered that after taking into account this analytic structure, all 17 pages collapsed to a single line of some multiple pole logarithms. Okay? And another highlight is this very, very recent computation, which is basically state of the art in QCD, in which people are interested in computing contributions to parton-parton scattering, for example, producing the Higgs boson in association with a number of jets at the LHC. And in this case, you have to study all sorts of Feynman diagrammatic topologies. And there, at every stage of this computation, the studying analyticity is absolutely essential. Right, so let me wrap up the first part of this talk. And hopefully, I've convinced you that scattering amplitudes have a very intricate analytic structure. And actually, understanding this analytic structure is absolutely essential for modern precision measurements at the in quantum field theory. Right, so I wanted to actually make a small break in here in case any of this sounds exciting. You're in luck because we're actually organizing an upcoming conference called Amplitudes 2024, which is another instance of the next edition of our yearly series of conferences. It's going to happen at the IAS in Princeton in mid-June. There's actually going to be two events, the conference and the summer school, and all of you are, of course, very much invited. I particularly recommend the summer school to grad students and postdocs who would like to learn more about this fascinating subject. Okay, so now that we've discussed the applications to particle physics, I'm going to move to the second application that has been very exciting to me over the last couple of years, which is that of gravitational waves. So here, what we're going to do is we're going to move slightly beyond the S matrix. And as an example, we're going to study the gravitational Bremsschatten in the following sense. We're going to consider two heavy objects. Just because I wanted to be fancy, I'm just going to call them black holes, but they're really just any two heavy objects that are initially separated by some impact parameter B. And then they scatter off each other, okay, like so here. So I am not considering the in spiral problem, which would be the case in which the black holes coalesce. Instead, they're going to interact, but then in the end, they're going to fly out. So as the black holes interact, they actually emit some gravitational radiation. They lose energy to gravitational waves. And then you might hope that you can detect these gravitational waves later in some future observatory. Okay, so actually, this has been a very interesting problem over the last couple of years. In fact, the leading order in this parameter here, which is G Newton times the mass of the black holes divided by the impact parameter, has been computed by Kip Thorne and collaborators in the late 70s. And now the challenge that we've set ourselves is to compute sub-leading corrections in G Newton to this process. And in fact, we're going to do it using quantum field theory techniques. So first of all, we have to understand how to formulate this problem in the language of the quantum field theory. So this is actually an observable that goes slightly beyond the usual S matrix. So what you want to measure here is, roughly speaking, the expectation value of the metric in the kind of far field regime. So this is going to tell you this expectation value in the classical limit is going to tell you about how the space-time is being squashed and distorted as the black holes pass through. So the way that we're going to formulate it is as an expectation value. So I'm going to insert here a creation operator of the graviton H in the out vacuum. And I'm going to compute it in the background of the two black holes. Okay, so black hole 1, black hole 2 on both Bra and Ket state. Now, in order to make connection with the diagrammatic picture that I've drew before, it's actually easier to think about the outgoing graviton as first evolving back to the past with the S operator, then creating the incoming graviton, and then evolving back to the future, okay? Which is the standard trick. And then as the next step, we're going to, in fact, insert a resolution of identity right here, which is the trick that we've seen already before. Okay, in case this looks slightly complicated, let me just collapse all of that into a diagram. So the diagram is going to look as follows. Okay, so first of all, I have the black holes 1 and 2, which are these, you're supposed to see that they're blue and red lines. Okay, then they interact through the S operator here. And what happens next is that a graviton flies out, which is this wiggly line in here. Then I have to sum over all sorts of intermediate states X. Okay, so X itself could contain the black holes, but also all sorts of other gravitational radiation. Okay, so once I've summed over states X, then I have these states recombined through the S dagger operator, and then they fly out as two black holes back again. Okay, so once again, because of the dagger, I had to, if I think about the time or the causality, it has to be such that the time flows from right to left in this picture in here. Okay, this of course makes complete sense. If you think about measuring this graviton here, of course the graviton is the effect that that is after the cause. So it has to be both to the future of this bra and cat on the left and right. Okay, so the time of course has to go to the center. Okay, so this picture that we've just drawn, which is copied here on the left-hand side, looks awfully similar to the picture that we've seen before when we computed the cross-section. And we've seen that the cross-section is actually related to the scattering amplitude from the optical theorem as the imaginary part of the amplitude. So now that kind of prompts an obvious question. Well, is it possible that this interesting observable that we care about for gravitational waves is actually related to scattering amplitude in some way as well? And of course, I wouldn't bring up this topic if the answer wasn't yes. And we're going to find out that it's related to scattering amplitude through this notion of crossing. Okay, so to explain that, I will have to go on a small detour into explaining exactly some aspects of crossing. And then we're going to come back and we're going to apply all of the insights that we've learned from that into this explicit computation. And I'm going to show you the plot of the gravitational waves. Okay? So the small interlude is going to be, even before talking about crossing, I wanted to make sure that everyone is on the same page about the CPT theorem. Okay, so the CPT theorem says the following. Let's say I have my matrix element in here. Okay, so as a very concrete example, let me choose E plus, E minus, annihilating into radiation. Okay, gamma, 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 let's say. The CPT theorem says the following, that you're supposed to apply the CP transformation, which exchanges particles and antiparticles. So for example, E plus, the positron, is going to become E minus. And likewise, you have to apply the T transformation, which is going to exchange the incoming state with the outgoing state. And the theorem tells you that if you apply both at the same time, then the result is actually the same. So in this case, the matrix element for this process is the same as three photons creating an E minus, E plus pair from in this process. Okay? Now, what we're going to do next is study crossing, which is actually an even more interesting operation. What you're going to do is you're going to apply, roughly speaking, the CPT transformation, but only to a subset of your particles, and the other subset is going to stay untouched. Okay, so let me first consider the 2-2-2 scattering, in which case this is very well understood. Okay, so let's consider this process in here, in which I have two particles, say 1 and 2, interacting through S into 3, 4. So I'm going to continue with the example of E plus, E minus, going to photons. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to choose my two victims, the positron and the photon. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to exchange their energies and the nature of particle into antiparticle. So if I do this, what's going to happen is that the outgoing photon became the incoming photon. It's its own antiparticle, so I don't have to conjugate it. And the incoming positron became the outgoing electron. Okay? So I have this matrix element in here. And now I wanted to understand how exactly are they related. So one simple observation, if we look here, we have this center of mass energy squared, which is, of course, has to be positive on this level. But the same variable that I used to call S, in this case, P1 plus P2 involves one incoming particle and one outgoing particle. So it no longer has the interpretation of the energy. Now it has the interpretation of the momentum transfer, which is space-like, so it's negative. Okay, so I have to understand how to go through this process, which is defined for positive S, to this one, which is defined for negative S. And as you might expect, they will be related by analytic continuation in the upper half plane of the S variable, which is an old result. Okay, so this is the picture. If I consider my complexified kinematic invariant S, the two scattering events are going to be on two sides of the positive and negative, on the positive and negative axes. There's actually a possibility that there's these singularities that I talked about in the first part of this talk, the anomalous thresholds, which in principle could hide somewhere here close to the origin. So what we have to do is we have to go around them. Okay. So I think here it's kind of worth to pause for a second and just emphasize how crazy this relation is. Okay, so on this side we have E plus, E minus going to gamma gamma. Okay, so just a pair of a positron and electron annihilating to radiation. On this side we have Compton scattering. Okay, so two kind of physical events that are governed by different, they describe different physics, but nevertheless, what this result tells you is that if you know one, you know the other as well. So this is both kind of theoretically interesting, but is even more interesting practically, because it means that if you've done this computation here and you've suffered a lot, or maybe your grad student suffered a lot to say compute this to 5 loops, then you don't have to start from scratch if you want to compute this process. What you can do is you can take this formula from the left, from the right hand side, and just continue it to the left.
In practice, the fact that they are analytic continuations doesn't mean that the computation will be very similar anyway. So if you suffered a lot, okay, you change a few eyes. It's not like you're starting from scratch if you want to do the other one, right?
It could be. So if these were identical particles, the computation would be quite similar. Where there's a lot of power is if you cross particles of different species. So I agree that morally speaking, the computation in terms of Feynman diagrams would look similar, but of course a lot of details would have to take care of. Okay, so. At this stage, I wanted to kind of also tell you how constraining this whole business of thinking about basic physical principles such as unitarity, locality, causality, and now together with crossing symmetry for constraining 2-to-2 scattering amplitudes. This has been actually done in two guises. The first one is called the S-matrix bootstrap. In fact, Pedro here is an expert on this topic. And another one is called bounds on effective field theories. And what both of them share in common is that you're looking at some space of allowed coupling constants and masses in your theory. The details don't really matter. But what matters here is that putting these constraints from these basic principles gives you some exclusion plot. So there's some theories that are for sure excluded by these unitarity constraints and crossing symmetry. And then some theories that are included. So if you wanted to know more about this topic, I would invite you to talk with Pedro or Andrea or other experts in this building. OK, so now I can get a bit closer to the final goal. The final goal actually requires you to answer an old open question that has been open for around 60 years, is what happens if in the very same way, now I start with 2-to-3 amplitude, so higher multiplicity amplitude, And in the very same way as what I've done before, I take two particles and I exchange the incoming one to be an outgoing antiparticle. Okay? So you might have some expectation what happens if I start with this one and go on the left-hand side after the result of the unannealed continuation. You might expect that the result will be yet another scattering amplitude, maybe complex conjugated or something like that, which is kind of a natural expectation. But it turns out that if you go through the details of this computation, you'll find a surprise. Okay? So let me move closer and closer to the case that is interesting to us at hand. Okay, so I'm going to consider a scattering of a graviton with a black hole, such that after the interaction, the black hole flies out, but then it creates the pair of the two heavy objects and its conjugate. Then I'm going to take these two states, the incoming graviton and the outgoing black hole bar in here, and I'm going to cross it. And the result of that, after you're careful about all the details, is as follows. So as you might expect it, the incoming graviton became the outgoing graviton in here. And the outgoing black hole bar became the original black hole incoming. But it turns out that the pattern of interactions is different to what you might have expected. In fact, it's the pattern that we've seen as a motivation for studying the black hole emission of gravitational radiation in the black hole scattering. Okay, so to understand this a little better, it's actually useful to take the right-hand side in here, take this S operator and decompose it into the identity plus the interacting part, like what we've seen before. And then you would find that the identity simply means that these black holes pass through. Okay, so they create this blob in here, which is the naive expectation, but the naive expectation is actually corrected with this cat contribution. Okay, so this is yet another starting point of a great adventure into analytic properties of the S matrix and trying to understand to what extent it's connected with other observables. But I'm going to leave all of that perhaps to questions after the talk. And for now, I'm just going to move to the highlight of this computation, which is the first computation of the gravitational Bremsstrahlung, the next to leading order. Okay, so after you've done all of this computation, analytic continuation, blah, 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 in the end, you're going to get a plot. Okay, so the plot could, what you can do is you can compute the expectation value of the metric. In fact, you can compute its two polarization components in this way or this way, like you learn in your GR classes. And then we plot both of those components as a function of the proper time. So it's done in such a way that tau equals zero is the place when the two black holes are the closest to each other. Okay, and then I plotted it for some specific scattering angles and a number of velocities as a fraction of the speed of light. Okay, so as you might expect, what happens here is that as the two black holes graze of each other, they emit some profile of the gravitational waves that make some funky shape, and then it comes out. Okay? But one feature that you can notice in this profile is that indeed the metric settles in, but it doesn't settle to its original value. Okay? In other words, it actually remembers what happened in the process of the two particles flying in and out. Okay, so people in the business call it the memory effect. So let me explain that memory effect a little bit more. So the physical intuition for this memory effect is that of infrared divergences. So recall that in contrast with UV divergences, which is something that we usually want to get rid of in the S matrix, we should not be getting rid of the infrared divergences because they contain a lot of long-range physics. Okay, so let me illustrate it at the level of this formula, which is mostly for the experts. If you compute the expectation value of this graviton, it's equal to the tree-level computation times this exponent or exponential with two terms in the exponent. Okay, the details of this don't really matter because I'm going to explain physically, a posteriori, where they come from. So the what's happening here in the space-time diagram is I have my two black holes, one and two, that come together, they interact, and they produce this graviton and perhaps other stuff. Okay, there's actually two sources of the time delay, which is related to these terms in the exponent. First one is as the two black holes approach each other at relativistic speeds, they actually approach each other with a time delay compared to how they would have done that in the vacuum. Okay, so because of their two-body interactions. Okay, so let me call this the time delay, this blue term. You can actually compute it within the GR, and it agrees with this blue term that we've seen from the amplitudes computation. And likewise, there's also this more standard Shapiro time delay associated to a graviton. The graviton escapes the gravitational pull of the two black holes, so it's delayed, corresponds to how we would approach infinity in the vacuum, and you can compute this time delay, and it's equal to this term, which reproduces this factor in here. Okay, so we see how the studying scattering amplitudes and related objects can give you some insights into the physics of long-range particle interactions in this case. Okay. So the summary of this part of this talk is that there's this notion of crossing symmetry, which exchanges incoming particles into outgoing antiparticles and vice versa. And it turns out that it connects different observables beyond the S matrix. And this turns out to be very practical and can be used to obtain new results in gravitational wave physics and perhaps in the future beyond that as well.
Yeah, can I ask a question? So as the black holes are coming together, they're being accelerated. So they are emitting gravitational radiation from a very early time. Is this calculation capturing that?
Yeah. So you can also include corrections from radiative. So you can insert the graviton lines in here. That is not taken into account in here. Okay. Okay. So now I've discussed particle physics and applications to gravitational waves. Lastly, I will move to more formal topics, including high energy scattering in string theory. So for me, string theory is exciting because it gives you a practical window for studying questions in quantum gravity. So let me give you one example. We can ask what happens if I take two strings, I smash them together at high energy, and then a number of other strings come out, for example, two of those. And by quantifying the scattering amplitude for this process to happen, I want to understand the particle interactions at some given energy scale. So what I'm going to consider is what's going to happen as the energy scale is comparable with the Planck scale. Okay. So those of you who are familiar with perturbation theory in string theory would know about Euclidean world sheets or Riemann surfaces. So let me contrast that aspect of string theory with the Lorentzian approach.
Sorry.
Using Lorentzian world sheets. Yes.
It's not string. It's not the energy equal to M Planck. It's energy equal to M string.
Sure. Yeah, we can do that. These are parameters anyway. So.
Yeah, but physically it's very different. One
yeah.
Is dominated by fluffy strings. One is dominated by soft gravity strings.
Yeah, I agree. So here I'm considering fixed angle, so hard scattering.
Yeah.
So this would be M string. Sorry.
It's not this.
Yeah. This should be M string. It's great. Good. So the Lorentzian computation is the thing that you might have encountered in the textbooks, which is my Euclidean world sheet, for example, a disk. And then what you do is you shrink the strings into vertex operators, in this case, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then what you have to do is integrate over all geometries of this world sheet and all positions of the insertions of the vertex operators. So the reason why we... So as I mentioned, this is a textbook formulation, and the reason why we formulate string theory in this language is that it's very easy to use the language of conformal field theory and compute these correlators. However, we know that what we're supposed to do physically is we're supposed to talk about Lorentzian wall sheets. So in this case, we want to ask a question, what happens if I have two strings? The two strings combine, then interact, and they fly out as two other strings, 3 and 4, as the time moves up in this picture. Okay, so this approach to string theory is actually not very well understood. And I'm going to argue that even though it's not very well understood, it's actually essential for practical computations in string theory at finite energy. Okay, so the thing that we want to understand for now is how to perform the wick rotation between the left and the right picture. Okay, the way that this is done is by going to regions, to geometries of the wall sheet, in which they develop these long necks. Okay, so the long neck, there's going to be a string mode propagating within it. And you can think of it as, roughly speaking, looking like a Feynman propagator. Okay, you can make all of this more quantitative by actually assigning the length of this neck, which physically is the Schrödinger proper time tau that elapses between these two interactions. Okay, and then what you're supposed to do, according to a prescription given by Edward Witten, is that you're supposed to integrate over all wall sheets in this tau complex plane, first starting with the Euclidean case, and then, as we've seen before, if you wanted to go to the Lorentzian case, you perform a wick rotation from the real axis to the complex plane. Okay, you actually only have to do it for very large proper after very large proper times, and this prescription has actually two advantages. The first one is that it has the correct physical meaning of the Lorentzian evolution of strings, and the second of them is that it actually avoids some divergences that hide somewhere here on the real axis. Okay, so just to emphasize that none of this is a joke. You can actually use this in practice, and you can even numerically plot how the strings interact. So here I've plotted these wall sheets as the string 1 and 2. They first start evolving in Lorentzian time, and they actually create these ribbon patterns that I didn't know about until recently. After they've evolved freely, they actually interact by tunneling to Euclidean signature, and then they fly out as a number of other strings. Okay, so these ones, they look like they want to dance. They're doing some dance moves or something like that. Okay, so to emphasize the connection with the previous part of this talk, you can actually make a crossing transformation in which the result of crossing would be measuring expectation value, say, of this ribbon here in the background of these two, which are to the past. So this is the way in which we folded the time from this wall sheet to go to this wall sheet. Okay, so this is all fun. However, well, so far the discussion has been at tree level.
Sorry, just
and if you, yeah.
What was involved in doing these plots? What was done to plot them?
Well, I can describe it in more details after the talk, but roughly speaking, you do analytic continuation of the part of the upper half plane that is the closest to the punctures. And these ones are the ones that you move to the complex plane. So this gives rise to these segments that attach to the otherwise Euclidean worksheet. I can explain this after the talk. Does it make sense?
So it's a plot of the minimal surfaces that you get from Grossmander, where close to the puncture you weak rotate.
Everything is correct, except for the fact it's a generic wall sheet. It's not the minimal one. It's a generic point in the moduli space.
Okay, so it's still a saddle point, but it's not a...
It's not a saddle point. It's a generic point away from a saddle point.
If it's not even a saddle point, then what sense is there to say it's a particular surface? Then it's totally off shell. I can draw anything, right?
Yeah, yeah. So you have to integrate over all ways of drawing this picture, essentially, right? This is a generic surface. Okay, and the reason why there's these ribbons is that as you might know, if you do it naively, the embedding coordinate x mu would be purely imaginary. So this is the reason. This is plotted in the real part, and this is the reason why it looks perhaps slightly unconventional. Okay, so we can discuss this later after the talk. Let me just slowly try to wrap it up. As I mentioned, we wanted to go to quantum corrections because we're interested in quantum corrections to strings. So we need to include some loop terms in the loop expansion. Here's one example that experts would recognize as the textbook formula for computing a four-point amplitude, say in type one planar contribution to type one superstring. Okay. There's some explicit formula that depends on the positions of the punctures and the modular parameter tau that you might think of just plugging in some numbers for the kinematic invariants, some specific energy and momentum transfer. And then you would think that you can just click shift enter and get the right result. However, the reality is slightly more complicated. There was when you try to do it, there's actually a loss of precision. In fact, according to Mathematica, they put it in a more dramatic way. They called it the catastrophic loss of precision. And the catastrophic loss of precision is precisely because of these divergences associated to Euclidean evolution that I mentioned before. So I would try to argue that these textbook formulas, well, it's really great that we can write them down and we can study some physics with it, but they can be used in practice if you're interested in studying finite energy scattering in strings. Okay? So what you need to do is you actually need to fix this by implementing the appropriate Lorentzian time evolution. So this this slide is mostly to the experts who would recognize the upper half plane in the modular parameter. And what we have to do in this plane is we have to integrate over the geometries of the planar annulus and the Mobius strip. They're associated with these kind of contours. And this little detour close to the real axis is actually responsible for the Lorentzian evolution of these strings. Okay, so I could go on and on. And this is really an exciting time because it's the first time that we can actually compute a lot of objects associated to the quantum corrections to the Veneziano amplitude for the first time, including things like cross sections, partial wave coefficients, decay waves, and so on and so on. But since I'm very close to saturating my time, let me just give you one highlight, which is the very last plot of this talk. Okay, so this is the first evaluation of the one loop string amplitude at the finite value of the energy. So what you're looking at here is the real and imaginary part of the amplitude, okay, the planar contribution to the type one superstring scattering of gluons as a function of energy S for some fixed scattering angle theta, in this case fixed to pi over 3. Okay, so let me explain this plot slightly better. Okay, so first of all, we are on the logarithmic scale, okay? So as you can see here, the plot actually spans 8 orders of magnitude, so it is a bit challenging to do it numerically. You can notice these spikes in here, these lines in here. They're only here because we're on a log scale, so each spike actually corresponds to a zero of the real or imaginary part of the amplitude, up to some normalizations. And one of the features that you can also observe is that these both real and imaginary part seems to follow a straight line, approximately. But we're on a log scale, so straight line actually indicates an asymptotic exponential suppression in the energy. This is actually in agreement with the old prediction of Gross and Mende, who predicted this exponent. But now we see that on top of this exponential decay, there's actually a lot of interesting wiggles back and forth. And all of those are, of course, associated with the dynamics of the highly excited strings that are somewhere in the middle. And we think that they can be used in the future to probe Planck scale chaos by studying the distribution of these wiggles.
Again, I have the same complaint. It's not Planck scale, it's string scale.
Sorry?
It's not Planck scale, it's
String scale. Yeah. Okay, so let me wrap it up here. I've mentioned that it's essential to understand Lorentzian world sheets if you're serious about studying finite energy contributions to scattering amplitudes. And then we've used it to extract some of the physics of string scattering and be able to plot the amplitude for the first time. Okay, so the summary of this talk is that we've seen how a lot of basic understanding into the analytic continuation between different observables back and forth in time leads you into a lot of new insights into particle physics, gravitational waves, and all the way to formal topics, including string theory. So with that, let me thank you for attention.
Okay, thank you, Sebastian. So let's start with questions from the students. Of course, everything was very clear, but you want to learn about something else? No questions from the students? Well, you can ask at any point, but now we can open the floor to general questions.
Yes, okay, so I know I'm biased in the motivation. Can you go back to the slide where you're talking about the memory effects? Or actually a little bit before. So when I had heard earlier versions of this, the motivation wasn't the same. So for you guys, maybe can you go two slides back where you're talking about the
uh-huh.
My impression was before that like these different crossing guys are coming from, Simone was, or you guys were looking at causality, then the relations between different cross amplitudes, right? So in practice though here, you're saying that there's an easier way to look at like the expectation value of the graviton in out state for some sort of informalism by crossing back to like one graviton in, like, sorry, my question is roughly,
yeah.
You want to compute the bottom side here,
yeah.
And then it's equal to the top. And how general is that if I didn't have two to two?
This is the object that we want to compute.
Yeah.
One method for computing it is by starting with this computation and taking the analytic continuation to the other side of the complex plane, and then perhaps followed by a classical limit. Of course, you can compute this object using different ways.
Yeah.
This is actually another way that you can do it. You can just compute the conjugated amplitude for this object and then add to it this cat contribution.
Yeah.
So depending on who you ask, this might be more complicated or less complicated. In practice, what we've done is actually done this in multiple different ways to make sure because there's a lot of moving parts and you want to be sure that the result is correct.
So say I was interested in like the gravitational waveform and like more like the second line but with arbitrary end state.
Yeah.
Is it true that also I can always have something where it's simpler to cross back, or this is really something specific, it looks very special to 2 to 2?
So this is 2 to 3. So in principle, you can add some more incoming states, and that expression will be still valid. Yes.
Okay. And my dumb question is, like, for example, here, if I go soft, I might think that I would get 0 just by nature of the fact that like it's 1 to 3 now.
Yeah.
Do I learn anything from trying to recast things to the top diagram or no?
So in general, no. So you wanted to take the soft limit at this stage and then continue. The problem here is that these are, in a sense, two limits or analytic continuation and a limit. These things, in general, don't have to commute.
Yeah.
In this case, I believe that I'm actually not super sure, but I would guess that they do not commute.
Since we are on this slide, have you considered when we study black hole, we're typically interested in coalescences rather than scatterings? Have you considered
yeah.
2 to 2 properties in which you have two black holes going into one black hole and an emitted graviton? And in that case, it's just a 2 to 2, so you can use all the machinery you explained before this slide. Do
yeah.
you predict the coalescence bring down?
Yeah, it's a great question. In fact, there's been a lot of activity in the field of scattering amplitudes that are trying to precisely address this question. So I talked about the hyperbolic orbits in which the black holes fly out. Of course, the one that is immediately the most, the regime that is immediately the most useful is the coalescing orbits. And that is also studied. There's a called computational pipeline that tries to compute the corrections to the Newton potential. So this is called either post-Minkowskian expansion or post-Newtonian expansion, depending on which parameter you expand in. And there the idea is that you compute basically GR corrections to Newton by giving higher derivative, by including the deeper terms in the expansion. And this is currently being used for, in combination with other kind of gadgets, things like effective one-body approach, to actually give you a handle on producing the kind of templates for the coalescent phase. But these are only valid, so these are valid in the kind of ring down phase, and they tend to break down as you go closer and closer to the merger. So that's one caveat. And it's actually, excuse me?
You meant inspired and not ring down.
Yeah, sorry.
In these 2 to 3, the computation you're doing are valid all the time, even in the moment in which they're very close together, the black hole?
Yes, but they're valid to the, in this case, to a G cube order, so to a given order in the G Newton.
Okay, thanks.
Then, of course, by including higher, so this was a one loop computation in here, but of course, by including deeper, higher loops, you can get deeper and deeper in the G expansion.
Thank you.
Okay, so in any case, so if there are no more questions now, you can ask more questions when you go downstairs. So let's thank Sebastian again.